Hello, and welcome to the 13th and final episode of Season 8 of The Dark Money Files, in which we shine a light into a murky world. I'm Ray Blake, and with me is my co-host, friend, and business partner, Graham Barrow. Hello, Graham.
Hello, Ray.
Part 3, Graham, the one where we start moving all sorts of goods all around the world.
Yes, Ray. I think we could be rather inventive this time round. But before we begin, do you want to do a quick recap of the ground that we've covered so far?
Yes, I'd be glad to. In part one, we looked at what you might call traditional money laundering, putting cash through the system in volume without attracting unwelcome attention.
Yeah, and it was lots of cash, as I recall.
Oh, millions, Graham. And of course, with the recent NatWest case, real-life corroboration that this was not being overly fanciful.
As if we would ever be fanciful, Ray.
Well, as if. Moving on, in part two, we looked at one specific form of trade-based money laundering, one which accounts for most of the money moving through the so-called laundromats, and that's fake invoicing.
And very effective it was too, but it's not the only way to launder money through trade.
No, there's over-invoicing, under-invoicing, oversupply and undersupply as well. And it's those that we're going to cover today.
So are we going to set up an import-export business then?
Oh, well, a few of them, I think, Graham. We need to think big here. After all, we're high-end money launderers. None of your riffraff.
No, indeed we are. So, TDMF Impex is open for business then.
Well, yes, but only in our imaginations, Graham. I think we both know that we've got a loyal following among the law enforcement and intelligence communities around the world, and we don't want to be spooking them unduly, do we?
I didn't think we were supposed to mention that, Ray.
Oh, don't worry. I didn't name any names, and I'm sure they're not listening that carefully. Actually, I'm sure of no such thing.
well, let's hope so. But just to be on the safe side, and for the benefit of the tape, only in our imaginations, Ray.
Okay, well, I think they'll have got that message, Graham.
Yeah, hopefully. So where shall we start?
Well, I think under-invoicing with jewellery. It's never a bad time to talk bling.
As a man who eschews pretty much any form of ornamentation, brave words.
Well, I did say talk bling, Graham, not wearing it.
I stand corrected, Ray. Well, actually, I'm sitting down, but you know what I mean.
Well, I think you ought to sit down at your age. So I thought we'd go horological. And use watches. Ooh. Now, the premise is this. I've got loads of money here in the UK, and I want to get it to Brazil. I've been offered the chance to buy some black market Rolexes. Is that the plural? Rolexes? Let's go with that. Yeah. Which are hard to dispose of here, but for which Brazil has a ready market.
In our imaginations.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an extended exercise in imagination.
Yes.
What's on offer are some bog standard Rolex oysters, if there's such a thing in relation to Rolexes, at £3,000 a go. Now, I buy 1,000 of those black market Rolexes for £3 million, but obviously I don't want the bill of lading to show that they're Rolexes.
Okay, let me just stop you there. I think we should explain what a bill of lading is in case anyone in our audience doesn't know.
We should, yes. The term derives from an old English word, which means the same as loading, and was originally issued to confirm goods had been loaded on board ship.
But it doesn't just apply to ships these days, does it?
No, it's used for goods transported by any means that cross an international border. So you'd have a truck bill of lading or an aeroplane bill of lading, as well as a container ship one. It's got a specific contractual relevance, which is kind of beyond the scope of this podcast. But suffice to say, it's the means by which, for example, the contents of a container is identified.
And container shipping accounts for a huge amount of global trade, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. In 2019, just before everything went slightly wonky with the world, 80% of all global trade was conducted through maritime shipping, and container trade accounted for 60% of that. So I suspect a fair amount of the rest was liquid shipping, oil and gas and the like. So containers were far and away the most used method for moving other goods around the world.
And given the sheer volume of containers, and if you've ever seen one of those container ships, they are just enormous.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it just cannot be possible to physically check every one of them.
Well, hence the importance of the bill of lading.
Yeah, so I guess really probably 99% of the time or more, whatever it says on the bill of lading is really the only means of knowing what's inside the container.
Yeah, I mean, you'd probably want to hedge your bets a little bit by having something in the container that approximates to what's on the bill of lading, though, if you intend shenanigans, Graham.
Yes, I think you're probably right. So to return to our original plan, we're not going to put Rolexes on the bill of lading then?
Well, that would rather defeat the object, Graham. We want to move money from the UK to Brazil, so the invoice needs to be for a very small amount, even though the value of the watches is high.
Which means, and I mean no offence here, if you categorise them as, say, Casio watches, you would have to open up the container and take a close look to work out that they weren't.
Yeah, if you mention a manufacturer's name at all. And the invoice would be for a fraction of the actual value.
Well, exactly. Now, I checked the web before started recording, and I found you can buy a basic Casio quartz digital watch with a plastic strap for 15 quid.
I own a couple of those, actually. Yeah. I think
they're actually very good.
Meaning that 1,000 of them would be invoiced for £15,000.
Or, if you prefer, £2,985,000 less than the actual value of the cargo.
And when they arrive in Brazil, you sell them on for the £3 million black market value, in the process transferring all of that money, less the £15,000 purported cost of the watches, from the UK to Brazil, without the money flowing through the global banking system.
And of course, if you wanted to create a flow in the opposite direction, you buy 1,000 £15 Casio watches and invoice them as 1,000 Rolex Oysters.
You pay £15,000 for the Casios and receive £3 million on payment of the invoice. That's a movement back to me rather than away from me. And both movements are very useful as part of a money laundering scheme.
All well and good, but it's sometimes a bit more complicated than that, isn't it?
You mean with the utilisation of trade finance?
Exactly what I mean.
Yeah, we're going to have to explain this quite carefully, aren't we?
It is not the most straightforward or simple of processes, so yeah.
Right, okay. So there are lots of different flavours, so we're going to do something very, very vanilla, and we're going to work through a letter of credit example.
Yes, before we do, ought we explain why trade finance might be included in the process?
From the money launderer's point of view, it's all about adding additional complexity, Graham. The more complex the process, the harder it is to identify who did what, why, and where exactly the money came from and went to.
Now that makes sense. So shall we explain how letters of credit work?
Yeah. So the main difference is that there will be two banks involved now, one acting on behalf of the seller and one for the buyer.
And this is actually really common, isn't it, Ray? It's actually a great way, legitimately, of protecting yourself if you've never done business with the buyer before, or you want to ensure you get paid promptly for your goods.
Well, exactly. The seller requires the buyer to pay with a letter of credit as soon as the shipment has been dispatched.
Now, his local bank is unlikely to provide one unless the funds are actually available to the bank. So I guess there is some cost involved.
Yeah, but it gives both sides some reassurance. The seller won't get paid unless the goods arrive. But the seller also knows that when the goods arrive, they will definitely get paid.
And the bank will only release the funds once the seller confirms the dispatch of the goods, usually through providing copies of the bill of lading, along with dispatch and arrival dates and, you know, the method of transportation, you know, the name of the boat, whatever. and that the funds will be sent via wire transfer to the buyer's bank.
And that's it, in a nutshell. It's like a kind of grown-up version of the PayPal escrow system. It means Party A can dispatch goods knowing they will be paid, and Party B can pay for the goods knowing that they'll receive them.
Yes, because Party C acts as a ringmaster, only paying for goods and releasing goods when he can control both those things and neither side can default.
Typically, though, in trade finance, there will also be Party D and possibly a large chunk of the rest of the alphabet too. Yeah. And all that additional paperwork can then be used to obfuscate further the money trail.
Yes. Now, we've talked about fake invoicing and misrepresentation, but there's also just plain overpricing and underpricing, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. If you were concerned that someone might notice that your supposed Casio watches were actually Rolexes, Rolexi, Rolexophones, I don't know, you may prefer to describe the contents accurately, but price them incorrectly in the hope that no one notices, or if they do, don't have a clear idea about what the price ought to be.
And the wonderful thing about doing it this way is it does leave a paper trail for investigators to follow up on and compare to standard world prices.
Not only is that possible, Graham, it's been done.
Yes, it has, by the wonderful John Stanovich, who published a superb paper some years ago, should be said, which we've referenced in passing before.
Now, I think it would be a great moment to dive back into that paper in a bit more detail.
I can't agree more, Ray. One of the things we really love about the paper is how well it demonstrates the process of peer review and how that can improve initial findings across successive iterations.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's lay out the background. Mr. Stanovich, which you've no chance of spelling if you don't see it written down, had access to the entire US import and export records for all goods above a fairly low value.
Yes, and to help with the name, we'll include it in the blurb that goes out with the podcast.
Got far more consonants than you'd imagine.
It is consonantally heavy, isn't it?
Indeed, yeah.
Anyway, so we say a fairly low value, and that was $2,500 for exports and $1,500 for imports. So it actually captures the vast majority of trade that flows through the US.
Exactly. In his first iteration, he mined the data for any individual item which was priced abnormally compared to average global prices.
And it produced some eye-popping results, didn't it?
It did. US exports at low average prices included enriched uranium to Spain at $15.50 a kilogram.
You know, Words fail me at so many levels, Ray. Mm-hmm. I mean, enriched uranium. Mm. Are you even allowed to export that stuff?
Well, apparently so.
It just seems a very eye-catching example to use for dodgy dealing. But there we are. How did the price compare to the global average?
Well, that's $172.22 a kilogram. So it was less than 10% of that.
Well, that is quite a difference. So what about US imports at high average prices?
Well, how about getting your razor blades from Colombia for $34.81 each?
Do you know, even for a bloke like me, Ray, with a beard, who doesn't shave very often, even I know that's a bit pricey.
Yeah, and this was back in the 1990s, Graham. I mean, it was very pricey then.
That's an expensive shave. So is there anything that would be a bit harder to work out just from the price?
Yeah. I mean, intuitively, we know those are wrong. But what about cut emeralds at $974.58 per carat?
Well, okay. Well, it sounds quite a lot, but I've no idea whether that's just a bit expensive or is that way over the top?
Way over the top, actually. The average world price was then around $44 a carat, but very few people would be able to know that.
I would be one of those, absolutely. All right, but this method was criticised because it failed to allow for country product heterogeneity.
Well, that's easy for you to say, Graham.
Thank you. Did it without a fluff as well. So pleased.
Our listeners have no idea that's take six. But it's a fancy way of saying that stuff from one country wasn't always the same as the same named stuff from somewhere else.
Yeah, so like a dress from Haiti, no offence, might not have a comparable value as, say, a dress from France.
Well, exactly. So the next iteration looked at in-country difference and extracted anything that was more than 50% above the average local in-country price.
Which sounds a bit more realistic. So this iteration elicited, amongst abnormally high US import prices, safety pins from Canada at nearly $30 each.
They'd need to be solid gold at that price, Graham.
And maybe they were, Ray. Maybe they were. I'm kind of reminded of the James Bond film in which Auric Goldfinger took his big Rolls Royce across the Channel and into Switzerland with floor pans made from painted over solid gold. Mm.
A stretch rolls of golf, Goldfinger.
Very good.
Yeah, thank you. And amongst the abnormally low US export prices were refrigerators to Japan for $40 each.
Nice. And I couldn't help noticing that erythromycin sat on both sides of those tables. Oh. With imports from Japan at $1,693.83 a gram, alongside exports to Japan at 8 cents a gram.
That's a considerable difference, isn't it?
Do you know, I was going to include the percentage difference, but I couldn't actually work it out.
It's enormous, yeah.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, even Martin Shkreli, for those who might remember him, the farmer bro, might blush at that kind of markup.
Yeah, another chap with an overabundance of consonants.
Yes, exactly. Once again, this iteration received criticism for the arbitrary nature of the 50% threshold. Mm. So the last iteration used interquartile price range analysis.
Yeah, it's not worth getting too detailed exactly what that means, at the risk of revealing that we don't entirely understand either. But let's just say it's a more flexible statistical measure to apply to a wide range of prices in order to determine real outliers.
It certainly determined some outliers, right? Among the high US import prices were base metal tweezers from Japan, at very nearly $5,000 each.
Yeah, and that's just taking the mickey, Graham.
No.
Although, and we've mentioned this before, but it does deserve a repeat appearance. Exporting missile and rocket launchers to Israel at just over $50 a unit is impossible to ignore.
And it sounds quite dangerous.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's on a spectrum these days, Graham, isn't it?
Well, it couldn't be more timely. But to repeat, and this is important, these are real-life examples and not just some case study that we've made up for the benefit of the podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, you can bring this real-time as well. But when I looked after the compliance referrals from the trade finance desk in a bank, I had two really well-thumbed documents. One of those was a printed database of worldwide average commodity, raw materials and manufactured goods prices.
Oh, interesting. So you could make sure the paperwork and the value on it and the genuine value that these goods should have were broadly aligned.
That's exactly right, Graham.
That kind of makes sense, right? So what was the second one?
The second one was a list of dual-use goods, and I used that one to keep us safe from potential sanctions breaches. But I went to that list first every time.
And why was that, Ray?
Well, three main reasons, Graham. Firstly, a sanctions breach would open the bank to criminal liability, irrespective of the amount involved. So, big risk. Hmm. Second, it's a much shorter list than the all goods list.
Well, that's a good point. And thirdly?
Well, if I got a hit on dual-use goods, I could be fairly sure money laundering wouldn't be behind the transaction.
Because there are enough genuinely single-use and innocuous-looking goods, whether they're both real or imaginary, that you could have chosen that would cause no one to bat an eyelid without you calling attention to a dual-use goods.
Well, you've got it, absolutely. Money launderers, ironically, will always prefer to take the low-risk options and channels.
Although I can't help thinking about the enriched uranium, but there you go. It was in a world a while ago.
Yeah.
But hey, as we've noted before, Ray, the implications of that aren't always taken to the heart on our side of the fence. It's not all about stripy jumpers and swag bags.
So hopefully this has opened a few eyes. And given the current circumstances around sanctions and world trade, it's an important reminder just how easy it can be to move stuff around the world in plain sight, but with underlying criminality apparently undetected.
So we must hope then that since that report was published, at least the systems have improved dramatically and it's become much harder to do so.
Oh, we can but hope, Graham. Now, this is the last episode in Season 8, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Ray. And we've got a busy calendar for the next few weeks, but we will be back soon. And who knows what we'll be talking about then?
Well, we certainly don't right now. But whatever it is, I'm looking forward to it.